to the True Faith Newcastle United podcast, and it's a Christmas treat for everybody. About 3 weeks to a month ago, I had a slight feeling that things might go tits up in the world of Steve Bruce's Newcastle United, so we thought we'd record a podcast full of Christmas cheer and Christmas games when Newcastle United defy the usual convention and play well, win some games, maybe even go top of the table in a distant time. So you've got Anton, Nick and Paul, joined by True Faith regular Mark Corby, to talk about the games over Christmas that brought smiles to faces across the northeast and beyond in the world of Newcastle United fans. I asked these lads to do this podcast because they wrote such a fantastic article in the new True Faith, the new copy of True Faith, which is still available now to buy online and in a couple of shops in the city of Newcastle. So if you like what you hear, try it out. Please buy it. Hope everyone listening has a tremendous Christmas and a fantastic new year. We'll be back with all sorts of podcasts about the current Newcastle United, which I imagine, could be wrong, but I imagine won't be as fun. So thanks for listening. I'll let the lads take it away.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably no surprise that I'm going back to a period that I've discussed on many occasions. But, you know, overall, when I look back on my 35 years of supporting Newcastle, it's the period I remember most fondly and I'll speak about most passionately. It's Boxing Day 1992 and a fixture at home to Wolverhampton Wanderers. Just to paint a picture why I've went for this one is it's such a contrast from the start of 1992 to where we were on this particular day. You know, if I just paint a picture in regards to where we were at the beginning of 1992, obviously we had Ozzy Ardiles in charge. The club had, you know, no money whatsoever. We were facing potential bankruptcy if we were to be relegated to Division 3 as it was then. And I think the fact that Ozzy Ardiles had used a lot of youth players, players who had come through the ranks, the likes of Steve Watson, Lee Clark, Robbie Elliott, Steve Howie, etc. I think that bought them a lot of time. But ultimately, going into 1992, the games were coming thick and fast. The defeats were coming even faster. You know, the majority of the lads on here may recall New Year's Day in 1992, we went down 4-0 away at Southend United. And we quickly followed that up with losing at home to Charlton 4-3 after we were 3-0 up at half time. And you know, then we went down 5-2 at Oxford, who were bottom of the league. And also, when you consider third division, Bournemouth knocked us out of the FA Cup on penalties. You know, the writing was all on the wall for Ozzy. So you know, he had to go. But
happy days.
Happy days, but roll on the good times. You know, from February, as we all know, Kevin Keegan came in, 16 games to save us, and he did that, and that was it. We lifted off, didn't we? So on to happier times. You know, as we all know, 11 wins out of the first 11 games. It was, you know, just such a transformation, and every single game was just an absolute joy to be there. You know, for the younger listeners, you had to guarantee your place by getting a season ticket. It was unheard of back then, but that's the only way you could get in. We had a
ground only held about 29,000 then, I think, didn't it?
Yeah, it was. It had been reduced from around about 36 to just over 30,000. Because of the Taylor inquiry following the Hillsborough disaster, so the Gallagher end in particular, there was a big reduction in the capacity in there. But then again, back in the '80s, you know, the official attendance wasn't always correct. You know, I'd love to know how many turnstile operators took a cheeky £5 note to let more in. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I mentioned the 11 out of 11. And then we went on, we had a couple of defeats, and then we went, I think it was 5 wins out of 6. But the strange thing at the time, though, was we were getting a lot of television coverage. ITV's The Match was sort of, you know, showcasing all the it was the first division then, wasn't it? The second tier football. And as we were winning most weeks, we were featured a lot. But it was weird because we seemed to not play well when we were on live on TV. I've just done a quick recap there. The previous two Two out of the previous four home games we had drew at home to Millwall and Swindon, which were live on TV. So it was quite disappointing that we didn't seem to turn up for the live games. And when you remember as well, we went to Barnsley a couple of weeks before Christmas, and Barnsley was struggling at the bottom, and they beat us 1-0.
I was
down there, and it was about 6,000 or 7,000 down there, and we got beat 1-0. It was such a shock. But
I particularly remember that one because I walked inside of a police cordon. I think it was the first time I'd ever been to Oakwell, and I got out of the car. I was with me pal Chris, and we like walked down. There was a few coppers sort of hanging around, and we just sort of like went, how you doing, sort of thing. Walked past one of them. Walked towards the ground a little bit and then sort of turned back again. And this copper was like, you cannot walk back there, son. And I was like, what do you mean? I was just like walking, wasting time, a quick look where the ground was, and just going to head back and go and find a pub. No, you've come past cordon now. You can't go back. So literally I was in the ground at like, I think about 12:15 with a hot chocolate, and it was mint.
Yeah.
And then we got beat. Yeah. It was really good.
We got beaten. Yeah, I mean, it was rare to get beat that season. I think that was my third defeat. But going into the Boxing Day fixture, I think it was just like, it may have been a bit of a coming of age as well, because I was, 14? Yeah, I was 14 at the time, and you sort of just start dabbling a little bit with McEwen's Lager, shall we say, and Old English Cider. So, you know, Christmas, you sort of had a couple of cheeky cans stolen out of my mother's fridge before you go up. And but I always remember, you know, new scarf, new Christmas hat, new jacket. But the most important thing over Christmas wasn't what you got. It was just going to the match. But the Wolves game, you know, it was in one, a couple of things I remember. Is Wolves brought up a decent following, and they used to put the away supporters in what was the Leasers East corner at the time, a little pocket. And it's mad to think that they only got around 980 tickets officially. That's all it would hold, because obviously the rest of the ground was all Newcastle. And I remember there was just an edge to the atmosphere that day. I don't know if there was any history between the two supporters in the past, but there was an edge to it. And, you know, Wolves took the lead. Paul Cook, who I think he's been managing a few teams, lower leagues recently, he's scored and put them ahead. And I noticed straight away from my place in the Gallagher, well, the scoreboard, I noticed straight away that there was seemed to be a lot of skirmishes around the East Stand and the Leasers where the Wolves fans were.
You're right there, Mark. There was always a bit of edge with Wolves. I knocked about with a Wolves fan at university. I was at university 89 to 94. Right. So I knew him quite well. And I actually stood in the Wolves end, not at that game, but at St James's Park for another game. And there was always an edge in the Wolves, sort of like away support. They had a pretty hardcore, pretty hardcore, edgy set of fans. I don't know exactly what hooly porn term I should really use on such a family podcast, but the Wolves games always did, and he obviously knew lots of the lads there because he was 20, 21 like I was at that point. Mm-hmm. So he was meeting his mates up there. I just kept a low profile the one time I sort of went in with him, but he was a canny lad. I mean, he stood on the Gallagher, you know, pretty much at least once a month with me, so it was a bit of a reciprocal one. But yeah, it was interesting to see, as you say, the Wolves fans and how much sort of bile they were giving out and how much front they did have in those days.
Absolutely, and you've just triggered my memory actually, because on the walk to Molyneux, as it was back then, I'm sure there was like a subway, and you had to go through it, and the Wolves fans would stand over it and just throw bricks and bottles and anything at you back then. But obviously it's a different game, different experience altogether now.
Different experience. We were there in January, and yeah, I think you're right. I think there is a subway somewhere near the station. Then you walk across the road and then down this sort of long alleyway to take you through to the ground. And it was all very jovial, but I think the whole all-seat has changed it all, isn't it? There's not as much radginess as there used to be anyway.
Absolutely, and well, they took the lead. As I say, there was a bit bother in the corner, but the game just went on. Then, you know, it was just ignored. To be honest, where now, you know, the whole game would be held up and players would probably be taken off, you know, but then it just carried on. But I always remember we didn't really seem to be playing that well, you know, what we were used to, the fast flow and all, you know, all attacking football. And, you know, I wish I could look at the lineup and blame anyone in particular, but it was pretty much the regular lineup, apart from John Beresford was injured and Alan Nielsen had come in the side as a very capable fullback. But yeah, you know, just to remind you, the calibre of the players were hard compared to the previous season. Pav had come in due to Tommy Wright's injury, and, you know, the Pavel Azzurri, you know, foundation was set. Barry Venison right back, fantastic sign. He would make my all-time 11, to be honest.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Superb captain, could play across the back four as well. He was just a great player for us at those times.
Well, he got in the England team, didn't he, straight after that, and ended up playing in the sort of holding role. Almost like the David Batty role, and he was just brilliant. I mean, being a bit of an average sort of fullback to come at Newcastle. I always remember in that season, even when he was played, even in it was League One, as the Championship as was, he'd play at right back and he'd still get skinned a bit. But when they moved him in field, he was just a revelation, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, it was a stroke of genius by Keegan, that stroke of genius to shift him from fullback to number four.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Well, bear in mind, I would pick him as my centre half, because that first season in the Premier League in 93-94, when Steve Howie got injured, they moved Venison in the centre half, Watson right back, and I thought he was just fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. But yeah, the Barry Venison podcast will come soon, lads, I would imagine. Well, Kevin Scott, you know, he'd been around the club for a number of years. He had experienced the relegation, and he'd obviously experienced the disappointment of the playoff defeat, which we'll not go into. And Steve Howie, for me, that what a surprise he was, you know, when you think he was an alleged striker. And I always remember going down to Derby the previous season when we got beat 4-1 and we had three sent off. And Howie come on, and Keegan put him centre-half for damage limitation. Which is incredible, considering we're nearly four back to 2-2 at one point. But Howie was incredible, absolutely incredible. And then if you think of the midfield, Liam O'Brien, see you no more. Robert Lee had come in and really stamped his authority on the right-hand side. Lee Clark, who would be player of the season, absolutely fantastic. You know, he was right there all the way through the revolutionising of Newcastle under Keegan. And then good old Kevin Sheedy, you know, you sometimes forget about these players who did a job keeping us up, and also he played a big part in this first half of the campaign. And David Kelly, favourite player of all time, absolutely loved the lad. You know, he knew what it was like. It's a cliche, but it was true, wasn't it? He knew what it was like to wear the shirt. And I've met him on a couple of occasions. He doesn't understand that the affection and the love that Newcastle fans have got for him. And it doesn't matter how many times I was telling them. He was just shocked by it. You know, 25, 26 years later, he had a wand of a left foot.
He scored two in this game you're talking about, didn't he? I think.
Well, you've just stolen me thunder, haven't you?
Oh, sorry about that. Sorry, I do beg your pardon.
Well, just before half time, I think it was a bit of a scrappy effort, the first one. I think it was a Lee Clark shot. It was parried. And one of my good memories of this is David Kelly scrambled at home, but there was a sort of a claim that the ball had already crossed the line. So at that point, people were already celebrating. And I used to stand right behind the goal in the scoreboard. And I don't know whether you older lads will remember, there was three lads who used to always turn up with wigs on, big, bright wigs. And the always stood out, because obviously it was unheard of then. You know, it wasn't zany, it wasn't sort of banter. It was just, there were young lads and they had wigs on, but they were always on the telly, and you knew if you stood next to them, you would be noted. Well, they had a little bit of a little competition between themselves as well to see who could get furthest on the pitch to celebrate a goal. So I went and joined one of them on that equaliser, and I look back fondly at the season review, because you can see me jumping over the sort of the wall at the front, jump over with me little me beanie hat on and my hands in the air, and the cop has pointers if say get back in, where again these days you'd be chucked out, wouldn't you? You know, so yes, that's me little claim to fame on the sort of the track behind the goal celebrating. But you know, the icing on the cake for me was the winner, shooting towards the laser's end. The ball dropped to David Kelly, and he just caught it on the half volley from about 25 yards. and it just screamed into the top corner. And the whole roof went off. Well, I'm saying the whole roof. There was only two at the time, wasn't it? Because it was two uncovered terraces behind the goal. But absolute bedlam. And it was one of those games where to come back and win a game is incredible anyway. Then you've got the edge of what we mentioned before about the Wolves supporters. You've got the edge that the fact that Wolves were a decent side then, they would have been challenging. And as I said, we just fell away a little bit, but we're still top by some margin. But,
and they turned us over 4-0 as well at Christmas time. They've done us. I remember they've done us badly in one of the fixtures, I think, in a couple of years previously. So the games were always full of football, those ones.
Yeah, they beat us. You're right. They beat us on New Year's Day in 1990 when Steve Bull got four. Yeah.
4-1, that, I think, wasn't it?
They beat with 4-1. And poor old Kevin Brock, who I've just mentioned in a recent podcast, Escape. Article for True Faith, you know, that was the game where I remember it clearly. A fan jumped out from the benches, which is the bottom of the East Stand, shall we say, for the new listeners. A fan jumped out and just took a swing for him. Poor old Kevin Brock, he was closest to him. I think Wolves must have went 3-0 at the time. So yes, you're right. And bear in mind, that beat us 6-2 under Kevin Keegan in the previous season. So, just to conclude on that. You know, it was just a brilliant Christmas present, you know, to win 2-1 against a promotion rival. David Kelly getting the two goals and, you know, who was my favourite player. And I just think it sort of, even though we went off the boil a lot after that, I think we only won 2 of about 10 or 11 after that. And there was a little bit of a Portsmouth crept up. And I think they went top of the league at one point.
West Ham were close as well, weren't they?
West Ham were close. But it all come good in the end. I think Keegan was a master at replacing players with better players, shall we say. He replaced Franz Carr with, obviously, Rob Lee. He replaced Kevin Sheedy with Scott Sellars. And then Gavin Peacock was unlucky to get injured, but Christ, Andy Cole come in, and that was it, wasn't it? We just took off to a different level with Andy Cole and then Peter Beardsley. And, you know, the foundations were set in. We didn't look back, but as you can probably tell, lads, that period for me was just an absolute joy. 92 to about 95, 96. And, you know, it's just no mistake that Wolverhampton Wanderers game is probably the one I look back on with, you know, a lot of fond nostalgia, shall we say.
Just quickly, just talking about David Kelly there, a good mate of ours, Boda, who I'm no doubt will probably listen to this. He was... he met him just by chance in the pub with a couple of other lads we know on the day when, you know, when Keegan had let him go.
Yeah.
I think I'm right in saying it was Inventions, which is, I can't remember what it's called now, but it was Bar
Crow's Nest.
What's it called now?
Crow's Nest. Crow's Nest.
Yeah. That's it, right, the Crow's Nest, yeah. Well, I think it was probably Inventions back then. He was in there and he said, and David Kelly was in there and Boda was there with a couple of other lads. And he said he was like, they were chatting to him and like, he was literally in tears, like just gutted, absolutely gutted, just didn't want to leave. Was like, just, you know, just loved being here so much. And it was, really sad, you know. I always thought he should have been given a chance in the, you know.
Could he have done it in the top league, or was he a Dwight Gayle kind of middle person? I mean, he was brilliant for us in that season.
I think he could have done a job. I think he was good enough. Like, showed later on in his career. I think he was really good.
I think if you look back in hindsight at what happened, you know, when Beardsley come in, got injured, and then Keegan bought Malcolm Allen literally a day before the start of the season. Malcolm Allen played up front. When you look at it from that perspective, yes, he would have been given a chance. But and especially when you think Alex Matthew coming as well, which was an odd one. But to David Kelly's credit, when I've spoken to him at obviously at Talkings and things, and he just said, "Look, you've got to understand that every time I knew I was unwanted at a football club, I wanted to leave." He went, so when Kevin Keegan told us, I wasn't guaranteed first team football. Peter Beardsley was coming in. He knew he had no chance. And so even though he was probably devastated at leaving, fair play to him, he didn't want to sit on the bench.
Yeah.
And squads were a lot smaller then as well, weren't they? I mean, nowadays it would be buttons to have kept a player who had got you up there to just give him a season for a chance. But squads being much smaller just meant that, you know, there wasn't room on the bench because there wasn't that many subs.
Yeah, exactly.
And, of course, Keegan had disbanded the reserves, had he not?
That followed a couple of years later, yeah.
Right, okay. So I'm going to go for 2nd of January 96, the Entertainers season. Unbelievable season. I know Mark talked about his favourite season being, I guess, the promotion season. But my God, we didn't half get close to that that season. And 2nd of January 96. So there had to have been, and I had to rack my brains to try and remember the game, to be honest. So I had a little look back on YouTube and you know, watched it back or watched some of the highlights back. But must have been cold. There must have been some rotten hangovers on the 2nd of January. People have been drinking all Christmas, plenty of football going on, and then welcoming a team like Arsenal at St James's. Now, I can't remember. This might just be our esteemed leader these days, but I can't remember going to games and just expecting to roll up and turn teams over. But we must have turned up that day and expected to turn Arsenal over. You know, we were absolutely flying in the league at the time. We were 17 points ahead, 16 points ahead. I can't remember now. 12 points ahead, whatever it was, of Man United. And Arsenal coming to St James's with players like Merson, Platt, Bergkamp, Wright, Seaman, etc. Usually you would think, Jesus Christ, we're going to get turned over here when you cast all these, you know, we don't beat teams like this. And yeah, beat them. There will have been some late comers into that ground, 36,500. So it was a full capacity. And David scored in the first minute, which was amazing. I think it was about 58 seconds, something like that. So watching it back, Paul Kitson was playing up front. Actually, I had a Twitter conversation with someone today about Kitson. I think somebody had asked the question, you know, your most underrated player of all time at Newcastle. And one of the lads had put, actually sits behind me in the leasers, one of the lads had put Paul Kitson. And I'm like, not so much for me, but never mind. So anyway, Paul Kitson took a really good touch, knocked it back, and Ginola struck it from the edge of the box, and it went the back of the net, which is rather nice. So, you know, first minute of the...
it was a bit of a goalkeeping error, though, wasn't it, if I remember?
It was, yeah. I mean, it was a good strike, and the ball was lifting. Seaman went with his wrong hand, actually, just watching it back. And he sort of palmed it into the top corner, so it probably looked slightly better than it was, but it was a bit of a goalkeeping error, yeah. So I suspect that may well have shaken a few hangovers pretty early in the game. And I don't, as I said, I don't remember. You guys might want to chip in. I don't remember a lot more of the game, but I do know that first minute of the second half, somebody smashed a long Bruce ball over the top, and Solaire just ran onto it.
Bruce ball.
And stuck it. Bruce ball, yeah. Well, you know what it is. I mean, you wouldn't want Joe Linton running onto it, let's be honest. Callum Wilson, maybe, but certainly not Joe Linton. And he just ran onto it, stuck it under Seaman. But again, if you watch it back, it was a bit of a goalkeeping error. You know, David Seaman probably was getting on years by then, 96. I think he played in Euro 96, David Seaman. So probably coming to almost the... God, he did, yeah. So actually, he probably still was getting on in years, going to keep us going quite late. But two relatively poor mistakes by him. But, you know, a new year, or 2nd of January, so effectively a New Year's game. Getting a 2-0 win against Arsenal is brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So, yeah.
I always remember I remember that game for one thing, because I used to sit in the East Stand right opposite the sort of director's box in the Melbourne. And I remember all of the Arsenal board, who was there from Arsenal, when that second goal went in, they just all got up and walked out. And I was like, yeah. I think change might be afoot there. But I always remember that, yeah.
Well, I was a student back in 96. I'm obviously a couple of years younger than a couple of you lads.
You don't look so it, yeah, do you?
No, I don't. I don't feel it either, being your mate. But coming back from Manchester, where I was a student, that season was immense. It was actually my graduation year. That season with, you know, students right away from the round the UK, but they're all bloody closet Man United fans. You never saw any City fans back then, did you? It was all Man United fans. And obviously, whilst being so far in the lead, you just thought that season was going to be it.
Did you let your mouth go by any chance, Paul?
Did I what?
Did you let your mouth go about how we were going to win the league and how it was a done deal and all that sort of stuff?
No, not me. I was actually that same season. I went as a couple of you guys know, my best mate's a Man City fan and has been forever. So he took us into the old main road, and I think that was the 3-3 season when Albert scored twice, and Coutinho headbutted Keith Curl. Well, yeah, that was right in front of us, and we were in the home end, about five or six rows back from the front behind that goal. And it was just such a ding-dong game. You can't sit on your hands when you're in a away game, as you well know, Nick, when we were at Old Trafford a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And excuse me. And they were just chucking coins at us, because I think they were battling relegation that season. So that season that we were going for the title, Man City were battling relegation.
Me and Nick were in the away end for that one, the 3-3 one. And Curl and the ding-dong and everything. Yeah, that was always
literally right in front of us.
Mark, you'll enjoy that. Mark, you must have, I don't know whether you got to Main Road at the tender age of however you were, 12 or when it was. But yeah, when me and Nick went to Main Road for that game, it was sketchy as well outside there.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know what? For me, Man City have been or always were a very, I know we're going off topic a bit, always had been a little bit of a yo-yo club or roller coaster club like us. I see quite a lot. I did see quite a lot of similarities other than the money in terms of similar sized clubs, similar histories, similar sort of promotions, relegations, years in the doldrums. Obviously, they went in a Pontins League 3 for a couple of seasons or a season. I just think the edge there was because they were battling relegation at that season and probably nothing else. But, you know, they're a decent bunch of fans and a decent bunch of lads, yeah. But how times have changed somewhat. Now we're battling relegation most seasons, should we say. We're happy to stay up, and they're pissed off if they only win the League Cup.
Just a quick one, Paul. You mentioned Paul Kitson there, and two little things about Paul Kitson. He came in for Keith Gillespie. Now, obviously, we've got Keith on the Pro View, and I said this for years, long before I got to know Keith, and I've always said Keith Gillespie's injury at Old Trafford, that ruined our season for me, because we just lost the balance of the side. Kitson come in, and then Steve Watson come in, and then Ferdinand got injured and Kitson come back in, and then we just lost that momentum. And then towards the end, apparently Robert Lee went to Keegan and said, you know, we need Keith back in the side. You know, he was playing Peter Biesi, who, let's be honest, is probably 99% of supporters I know's favourite ever, best ever player. But playing him right midfield or right wing at that old age, he just wasn't working. So that's the interesting. You've reminded me about that when Kitson come in. But the other one regarding Kitson's, I think he's drive and his love for the game, I think, was pretty much gone. Even though he did come in and do okay at times. Once David Batty came in, and Kitson told me this when I bumped into him at the races of all places, and he said when Keegan disbanded the reserves, he used to travel up with David Batty, and basically David Batty, as you all know, is not really a social person. He just used to go to training, jump in his car and drive back down to Leeds, or I think it was Wakefield, where he said they lived. And he says, and he met a lass at university. Now imagine this, Premier League footballer, ridiculous wages, living in student accommodation with a lass. Used to travel up with David Batty to training, and then when the week was done, he would just stop there all weekend because he knew he would be nowhere near the first team. That's how it ended up being for Paul Kitson. But then
his wife, actually, oddly enough.
Right, yeah. And then he concluded with, but I made some good money, though. And I thought, you know what, mate, fair play to you. Because he went on to have a great career at West Ham. So fair play to the lad.
Yeah, I think he was a good player. I do. I don't think he was probably my...
Put it this way, you'd have him now, wouldn't you?
Yeah, have him now. Well, you would have him now, yeah. And he nearly didn't sign. Was that Kitson? Did he turn around? And Nick Hassel had said he failed his medical. Was that
it? It was wage demands. He knew,
but Newcastle came out, I think, and said he'd failed his medical, and then he changed his mind, didn't he? And said, actually, I do want to sign. He turned around and came and signed for us.
The only thing I remember is the wage demands, and Keegan basically told him where to go, but there was some sort of agreement somewhere in the middle.
£850 or something, wasn't it?
Who knows, mate? Who knows? But bear in mind, Kitson, he knew that his next move was going to probably be his biggest. He was well respected at Derby. And, you know, bear in mind, once Cole left, he was one number one striker. So, you know, it's mad when you look back. Good old Paul Kitson.
So, yeah, I guess just to summarise My little piece, yeah. Unreal season. Set in January 96. Was there anybody in that crowd that didn't think we were going to go in and win the title? I think we all hoped and dreamt. And ever since then, I think we're all pretty much resigned to never win anything, unfortunately. But, you know, we can always dream.
We're supposed to be uplifting people here, Paul.
Sorry. Merry Christmas.
Yeah, yeah. Don't blind us with the fucking truth here, Hoare. Come on.
Good old days. Good old days. We were going to go and win the league. We beat Man United 1-0 at home and didn't get beat from Cantona's goal. Salez was a hero. And the rest, as they say, is history. That's how I remember it anyway.
Right. So the two games in the magazine were Spurs and a home thrashing. But the one I want to concentrate on is the seesaw game. It's an away game like Mark's. So the wins taste five times sweeter when it's away from home. And it was a game I went to under duress. I wasn't going to go. Nick and our pal Boda were going to head down in a car and do the Saturday before Christmas game. I can't remember why I actually swerved it. Might have been money. I was still a student then. It might have been a variety of reasons. I know that Leeds had one hell of a side. That was when, talking back to Paul and Man City's role reversals, that was when Leeds were right in the ascendancy, spending money left, right and centre. David O'Leary, look it up, kids, you won't know about him now, but he'd actually organised and put together an amazingly fast, young side, full of talent, looked good right through from a stalwart Nigel Martin at the back, right the way through the spine and up top. Scoring loads of
goals. My young boys, he used to call them. My young boys.
Jumpers for goalposts. Young boys.
I'm going to win that now.
So there we were. So I wasn't going to go. And then Nick fell ill, tragically ill. So much so he couldn't get up off his deathbed. And I said that I'd not only go, but have a drive because my mate's car was a rear-wheel drive. And the snow was just starting to filter down. And I remember thinking, bloody Leeds, you're going to get beat. They're unbeaten at home, I think. They haven't lost at home for games and games of all season. So I was going down with a heavy heart. And Newcastle, for all their Bobby Robson, for all the sort of guile and the fun and the young players and the balance that Robson put in that side, we always sort of had a little bit of a soft underbelly, a little bit of the chips are down. Is Dyer actually going to do it? Who's that? Is Laurent Robert really going to play well every single game? So those Bobby Robson years, yes, it was an almost year again. But yeah, so away games, getting down there, okay. I don't think we even had a pint before. I think the roads were chocker with Christmas traffic. So in we go. It's freezing cold. It's even colder in Yorkshire than here. But we score first. I think it was Bellamy who scored it, notched it in. And of course, as Nick will back us up, the minute Newcastle go ahead in an away game, the first thing we do is say, I wish it was the 95th minute now. And so I think that was early on.
Yeah.
98th minute. So, yeah, I think that was early on, a quarter of an hour in or so. So I'm thinking, OK, maybe I've made the right choice. Maybe I'm here. Maybe I'm going to see the win. But then, bang, straight away. Lee Bowie had been in a little bit of trouble. I'll let the great and the good Wikipedia that. We don't need to go into the misdemeanors. But he scored and their ground absolutely erupted. It was unbelievable. They were so behind their team and they're so...
Horrible,
but they were horrible, but really, really passionate. You know what it's like out on the road. I mean, you know, big catchment for the whole Yorkshire round about and all that sort of bit. So they've got all sorts of sort of rural types, city types, all sorts. So they were just up for it. And then all of a sudden it looked like Newcastle's arse had gone as usual. It was... Were 2-1, 3-1, I think. I can't remember who got them.
I remember. I'm right in saying, Anton, when Bowyer scored, he came right down in front of the Newcastle end and was giving it large, wasn't he?
Yeah, he scored at the Newcastle end. So yeah, he was just pumped and on adrenaline. You could see that he was so game up and fired up. You know, like Maradona in the World Cup when he was sort of like eyes bulging. Bowyer played with a bit of that day, and he was all over the park, and he was, you know, he was all over Kieran Dyer, who can drift in and out of games as well.
Are you saying that Lee Bowyer was coked up in that in the game against us?
Hey, look, you know, speak to my lawyers about that.
don't forget, lads. Newcastle fans were giving them some abuse that day because they were singing "You're Supposed to Be in Jail." If you remember,
yeah, that's right. Him and Woodgate.
Exactly, and if I remember rightly, he was running to the Newcastle end and he was basically calling us C-U-N-T's. So I remember that well.
Yeah.
So, good old Lee for you. Who would sign him, eh?
Who would ever sign that guy? Yeah.
There's nothing like an away crowd firing a player up, is there?
Yeah.
Well, if you looked at the team sheets that day, we ended up with quite a few because I think Viduka scored. They got the third and we ended up with him as well. Batty was playing for Leeds. So 3-1 down and I'm cursing it. The snow is falling. Long drive back. Not looking forward to it at all. And then just the Christmas magic happens. It can happen, kids. Believe you me, it can happen. Elliot got a header. Then we got Newcastle got a jammy penalty. I mean, even Steve Bruce would blush at this one. I think I watched on YouTube a couple of days ago. It just bounces, innocuous. VAR wouldn't have anything of it these days. And she was taking the penalty, so he knew it was in the back of the net.
No, I thought it was Stonewall personally, but there you go.
Whatever. So it's 3-3, and I'm thinking I'm escaping with a point. But ended up being a bit of a ding-dong game there. We were on top, they were on top, and it was end-to-end football. Typical clash of the Titans at the top of the table, and it was all out. And then the magic happened. Dyer, a player who I ended up hating, played really well in the second half, pushed the ball through, and I thought Solano had taken it too far wide. I thought he'd taken another touch. I was low down. I remember exactly where I was, almost through the nets. So it was that low down at Ellen Road. I thought, he's gone too wide, but Martin was covering that near post, and Solano just popped it through. It was just sort of powering right towards where we were sort of stood, just to that Nobby's left-hand post where our right of the goal. And then it went, and it was just bedlam. I can't remember anything about the singing or whatever because we were just going absolutely apeshit, throwing ourselves around for the next sort of like 3 minutes. And then there was a long injury time, and then we'd won. And they'd been singing "We Are Top of the League" because we took them top. And then we were singing "We Are Top of the League" all the way out to the car park, out of the industrial estate, and all the way home. And it was just a superb, unexpected, spectacular day out, which can happen at a way.
What was it like when you left the ground? Because obviously at this point I was having my tixie licks and, you know, and having a bit of a lie down. So, having been to Ellen Road a few times and come out and thought, Jesus Christ, I'm going to get killed here. What was it like at that point when we won 4-3?
Right. Well, at that point, I knew exactly where the car was parked, and it was a very fast stride, get the hell out of there, eyes at the ground, no real celebration once you'd left the concourse. Just get to the car, get out of the industrial estate where you park on, and get on the way home. Because, as you say, Ellen Road after a game, well, Ellen Road before a game can be a little bit moody. So, no, we got the hell out of Dodge.
Nice one.
Sorry,
go on, Nick.
I was just going to say, lads, I think at the time, though, if you think of how far we had progressed under Bobby Robson that season as well, we're talking about Keegan and the progression.
Yeah.
The season before that was Bobby's first full season, wasn't it? And the likes of Pesidas, Cardone, players who it just didn't work, you know, and there was a rumour that Mick Wadsworth had a lot to say on the signings that come in. But when you look at Bellamy, Robert, Sylvain Distan had come in on loan, and then towards the end of the season we got Jermaine Jeanison, who I think slightly harsh, I think, because he was a good player. Replacing Robert Lee was always going to be difficult, but he ended up being a decent player. And, you know, Graeme Souness,
he won Young Player of the Year, didn't he? Jermaine Jeanison, who's at Newcastle.
He did. He won Young Player of the Year the following campaign, I think. I think Bellamy won it this year, and Genius won it the year after.
I really like Genius, but I think one of Sir Bobby's biggest mistakes was when Paul Scholes and Man United were coming at Old Trafford. Might have been that season, I can't remember. Mm-hmm. And he was bigging up Genius. They were 50 years apart on their birthdays, actually, just as an odd fact. He was really bigging Genius up. saying, you know, he's on a par and he's on a level with Scholes. And I think Scholes might have bagged a hat trick when they beat us 6-2 that day.
Yeah,
was it St. James? So, that was St. James's. Yeah,
St. James's, absolutely. Yeah, St. James's.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't. The guy who scored the hat trick was the, what's his name? The Macam centre half.
Was it not O'Shea? Scholes?
Didn't O'Shea score a hat trick that day?
No, Scholes got two either side at half time. He got his goals either side at half time, killed the game. We scored first and last in that game. Scholes scored
O'Shea definitely scored in that game though, I think.
But I think going back to that team and the Bobby Robson time to contrast with Paul's input, I think in a way Robson was almost too good too quick. For the simple reason we just became so expectant again and the rebirth had all happened. Yeah. The 5 years we've had a bit of a doldrums, we've had Doug Leach and tinkered with Hullett, and then Robson lifted us all again, but he lifted us so quickly that we just started to expect a little bit too much perhaps. And you know, I think maybe that was the downfall as we finished second, third, fourth, and then that awful season when obviously we just finished out of the Champions League. But
do you not think quickly going back to Bobby Robson there, it was really weird his time at Newcastle because he came in and pretty much saved us, yeah? And then, as Mark was saying then, some of the signings then were awful and we went back to being a really, really pretty bog average, pretty poor sort of Premiership side. He then got us the sort of time you're talking about now with the players you're talking about now, like right at the top of the league, brilliant. And then we sort of tapered off a little bit and, yeah, I mean, it's history, but we shouldn't have got rid of him at that time. It was a terrible thing to do. But it was he did have a bit of an up and down time. You tend to look back because it's a few years ago, and you think like everything was rosy, and it certainly wasn't. But yeah, but yeah, I mean, you know, when you look at what we've got now, to it, it's
well, yeah. You would swap. You'd go back, wouldn't you? You'd go back 100%.
Absolutely. Great memories. Yeah, I mean, if you think as well, that time we beat Arsenal, didn't we, the game before when we ended that horrible
league that night, didn't we?
Yeah, we ended that horrible record, didn't we? I think it was 27 games in London we hadn't won, and with each game it was getting more of a sort of, you know, rope around the neck sort of thing, wasn't it? But
the Arsenal game, that result was totally unexpected as well. Exactly. I think that was another reason why you just thought, well, we're never going to do it twice. But that Christmas was the stars all aligned. And for once, Newcastle actually did go on a run of wins. I mean, normally you just want to stumble through without getting too many injuries and not taking your goal difference and battering Newcastle across Christmas. Whereas that one was magical.
Brilliant. Well, last but not least, we have lost Alex, if the listeners are wondering where he's gone. The leader of the pack, the Kevin Keegan of us all, he's lost his internet signal. So it just goes to show you cannot win it all. So last but not least, take it away.
Yeah, and just talking about stars aligning there, where Anton was talking about there. The game I'm going to talk about is under Guardiola, when we turned over at Manchester United at St. James's Park. Just after New Year in 2012, it really was an incredible game for us for all to go to. We were playing the champions. We're sort of thinking, as usual, when you play Manchester United at St James's Park, you think, well, you take a point before the game because, particularly at this time, although it was a slightly fading Man United team, they had won the league. That was the last time they won the league. They were sort of a little bit on the wane. But even so, you know, really, always a really tough game. On this particular occasion, I'd purchased some corporate tickets, which were in the corner, the Melbourne Gallagher Corner, which is now that area is no longer there, but it was really good. It was like a little lounge sort of area, and I was with my dad, and I was with a couple of really good clients. So we're sitting there having a really nice time, but it was a bit strange because the table we were on was only sort of half full for about an hour before kickoff. And about maybe 10 minutes before the game kicked off, these two real sort of chinless wonders sort of walked in with a really, really horrible looking person, a real sort of like very sort of rotund Mancunian guy. And he was just straight away, he just changed the mood. That everyone around was like looking over and who's this guy. He started straight away sort of like kicking off about Newcastle and not being very nice. And so anyway, well, he sat down. We only had a couple of minutes with him, and I clearly despised him immediately, but went out, took our seats, and it was a great performance. We went 1-0 up. There was a superb goal by Demba Ba at the Leeds end. I think he took the ball over his shoulder and hit it on the turn and into the roof of the net, and absolutely brilliant. And so we're 1-0 up, and we pretty much bossed the game. So we get into half time, my friend's there at the table, and he's had a couple more bevvies, and he was giving it large again. We go out in the second half, and I think, as I wrote in my piece, I really wanted to go and watch the game, but I'm talking to like some clients, and I couldn't nip out. So, and it's on televisions, and I'm watching, and I saw we got a free kick, and I bustled past Mank Boy to like go and just nip out and see it, and it's Johan Kabay, and he's got this free kick on the edge of the box. Into the Gallagher, and I couldn't get to my seat, so I went out and I just sat on the top steps. You know those sort of moments you just like you can just see and replay them in your mind, and it just, as you know, it just goes into the top left hand corner. Brilliant bedlam. I turned behind me, and our Mancunian friend was he I can just see his little face in the glass, just like this picture of unhappiness and looking puce, a little bit like Alex Ferguson does when he's had a couple of whiskeys. So it was great. And then, but even then, you know, Anton talked earlier a little bit about the shitty pants of supporting Newcastle. You're 2-0 up, you're playing really well, you're battering Man United pretty much, and even everyone around, we're all cacking ourselves, we're all like, oh my god, we're, you know, it's 2-0, we're still gonna, are we gonna win this? And you know, until Phil Jones scored a hilarious own goal. And can I just quickly say, if Phil Jones becomes a Newcastle United player, it'll just be the pièce de résistance for Mr. Bruce, because he should be nowhere fucking near Newcastle United. But anyway, he scored a absolutely wonderful own goal, 3-0, brilliant. So that was, but it was up until that moment. Everyone's holding their breath until about 80 odd minutes when he does that, and then it's like happy time. So anyway, we went back upstairs, and this guy is like really, you know, when he's like really drunk, he's got these two guys with him who are obviously his like clients, customers up here, who are doing their best to try and sort of, you know, like sort of be nice and try and keep him on side. And he started really giving it large at the table after the game, and like we're all just sort of sitting there, just like laughing at him, you know. And he started going, "You just remember, you fucking lot, you Geordies, you just fucking remember, right? These 3 points at the end of the season when they keep you up." And the table next to me just like erupted, and it was like, you know, like Raj guys, proper, you know, proper. I think a few of the lads like from Gateshead and that, and they were like proper, like they weren't having it. And they give me a bit.
Everybody from Gateshead's a Raji, of
course. No, absolutely not. No, but these ones were. And they basically like got a hold of him, heard him outside, and that was great. And it was just just a real stars aligning game. Absolutely brilliant.
I think one of the memories. Sorry, just a quick one for me. That one of the memories I've got is for some bizarre reason. If you remember back in the early 90s when we changed sponsor halfway through the season, it was Green Ale Beers to back the Newcastle Breweries. So if you had to strip, you had to go to the club shop and get a sort of a patch to sew onto your strip because it just didn't replace them. And this was
like
the
green and yellow away strip.
Yeah, the green yellow one, black and white barcode strip. But this Man United game that Nick's referring to, that was the game that we changed from Northern Rock to Virgin. And
we did. You're right, yeah.
Yeah, the players had the same sort of patch where you could see Northern Rock on either side with the Virgin logo over. So it's mental because little things like that, you just think, we've got a new sponsor. Mike Ashley, you know, the team's building. Alan Pardew's getting playing good football. You've got a player in Johan Kabay, a striker in Demabar. You know, at that point, you just thought, you know, this could be the start of something special. And within what? A year? It was back to normality, wasn't it?
Well, that was the season that we had Bar, Cisse and Ben Arfa running riot, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. So
remember that? The game against Swansea away. They just ran riot in that game.
Yeah.
What you're saying there, Mark, is just there's been a two or three times probably when Newcastle have done well under Ashley and we get to a point and you just go, right. And you just know he won't put his hand in his pocket at that point and go on to the next level because he's not interested. Yeah. And that was a perfect example of that time. And, you know, I don't think any of us are like massive Alan Pardew fans, but to be fair to him, he did well at that point and we were doing well. And, you know, at that sort of juncture in a time, if you go, right, let's build on this. Let's get us up towards those Champions League spots or Europa League spots. Let's do that. But he's just not interested. All he wants
back then,
to do
is survive. You didn't have to spend 150 million quid to challenge. We just had to tinker with a few positions and spend a little bit of money that was self-generated anyway.
But he won't. And he won't. But that's what I'm saying. Every year in, year out. I mean, I know we're all sort of slightly on his side at the moment because he's trying to flog the place and we're hoping that, like, you know, what he's doing will work. But as a custodian of this football club, all he's ever done is keep or try to do is keep us just, you know, head above water.
Yeah. I think you look at two major periods of happier times. That season was certainly one of them in the most, you know, last 15 years or so. It's interesting that we've talked about Lee Boyer, we've talked about Bobby Robson. You know, when you look back at us qualifying for the Champions League, well, the qualifiers back in 2003, we had just bought Jonathan Woodgate, who I've said on so many occasions, best centre-half I've ever seen, without a shadow of a doubt. And what did 100%. We do? Yeah, and what did we do? We went out and bought Lee Boyer on a free transfer from West Ham when we didn't need a midfielder of his style. And when you've just hitting on the head, chaps, because when you think after this season, we went out and I think, was it Vernon and Nito end up buying when we didn't really need him? Am I right in thinking it was that summer?
Was he not the only player that we got that summer, Anita? And it was was he on a free?
No, I think it was a couple of million, but it was a midfielder who, in reality, he probably wasn't going to add much to the actual dynamic of the setup Pardew had. So as much as what we've discussed, I'm not a fan of Pardew at all. I still look back at his time of, you know, off the field incidents and, you know, the headbutt with Myler and, you know, end of the day, he nearly took us down. We had horrible, horrible runs, you know, the defeats against Sunderland. But that season and that summer, he was shit on basically, lads, because he wasn't back to take us to that next level.
So absolutely.
It's a shame.
But he didn't care either. Pardew didn't care because he was yet another Ashley man. Yes, man. That's all he was. I mean, he should never have come in the first place. And yes, he did a great job that season with us. And we played some really exciting football to watch. Yeah. But he was a yes man. So again, he was grateful to get a job. He was at Southampton in the old League One or what is currently League One, do you not? And then all of a sudden, Alan Pardew's your manager and you just think, what?
Yeah.
And then he was given an 8-year contract. It's like, that's just expired, isn't it? A couple of years ago. Unbelievable. God almighty. It's amazing being a Newcastle fan, isn't it?
It's certainly not boring, shall we say. And, you know, we'll not depress listeners by talking about current affairs, even though we've got to be honest, we won our last game 2-0. So let's end it on a high. Also, I totally forgot until I read the recent article in the True Faith latest edition. Robbie Elliott, happy birthday on Christmas Day, Bonnie lad. You know, one of the crop of players who I mentioned before who come through under Keegan, you know. So it's good time.
Absolutely love Robbie Elliott. He was brilliant.
Yeah, I mean,
when he danced, that was his celebration when he scored goals, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. Just to quickly, you know, talk about Robbie Elliott. He's a firm fan of Kenny Dalglish, and I've had conversations with him on Twitter. Shall we say we have?
I saw that on Twitter yesterday. He stood up for him, didn't he? He was like going, "It was the
PLC,
all sort of thing."
Yeah, but my argument always is, yeah, but he still sold the wrong players. He had to raise funds, but he sold the wrong players to do it. And this is a stat for you. When all said and done, Kenny Dalglish still spent more money than he raised at Newcastle. And that's you can't argue with that. You know, and when you think about how much we went backwards as well, it's incredible.
He sold Ginola and replaced him with Des Hamilton. this is a Liverpool legend.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, surely not. He clearly is a football man and he knows his football, but really.
Yeah, and on that a lovely note, we'll call it a day, lads. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you, lads. Unfortunately, we did lose Alex a little bit earlier on due to a technical issue, i.e., I don't think he's paid his bills for his internet. But thanks to everyone for listening. It's an absolute joy to keep on doing these podcasts. The feedback's incredible. Keep it coming, because the more feedback we get, the more ideas we get. We'll continue to do it until either we get bored of it or you do. So thanks again, and. Paul, Nick, Anton, thanks very much, lads, and have a cracking Christmas.
Cheers, Mark. Cheers, Alex. Thank you very much. Have a good Christmas, everybody.